I want to thank Wei Sui and Casey for inviting me here today. I think I'm going to move a little faster than Dan. I won't be as pleasantly slow. They wanted me to do a little bit of the history of the molecular toxicology and molecular tools and risk assessment. So this is a very little history of molecular tools and risk assessment. As far as I can guess, it goes back to the Ames assay in the early 1970s, looking at the genetic toxicology of compounds. It's very basic, simple in vitro assay. You have these things growing in the plate. If they mutate, they continue to grow. If they don't, they die. Or it's the other way around. I don't remember. But it's so long ago. Either way, this had a big impact on chemicals in the United States. Because as soon as this assay was there and we started to actually look at the linkage between genotoxicity in the Ames assay and carcinogenicity and saw some strong linkages, companies stopped using genotoxic compounds in their chemical formulations. Too bad that's the only one that we've been able to do. But that was the genesis for a lot of molecular toxicology. There were a broad array of tools that came after this that are much better for looking at DNA breaks and much better for looking at mutations in cells, but this was the first one. Since then, a lot of the molecular biology focused on receptor biology. Much of it grew up from the dioxin PCB studies looking at the AH receptor and the biology in and around the AH receptor. That was followed very closely by work on the estrogen receptor and overall toxicity of estrogenic compounds. And all of this was opened up for us in the molecular biology field by RT-PCR, real-time PCR. It made a tremendous difference in what we could do in the laboratory and our ability to look at genetic control in the cells. The revolution that came after that with gene chips was a direct consequence of RT-PCR. So it's RT-PCR that really opened this up for us. The third area that really got into the gene and molecular events associated with toxicity had nothing to do with animals. It wasn't clinical anymore. I mean, it wasn't laboratory research, but metabolism genes in humans, chemicals, and cancers. There was a whole series of research in the late 80s, early 90s that focused on this gene-environment interaction in humans, which opened up a variety of new areas for us to study as well, and broader linkages between the human toxicity and to chemicals. Once the genomics came in and we had gene chips and things that were these multi-array data tools in molecular biology to start looking at how chemicals affected animals and cells and everything else, the first thought that came up for risk assessment was the idea of fingerprinting. The idea would be that I take all these multiplex signals and in some neat statistical bioinformatic way, I can turn it into yes or no for toxicity. So that was the general idea. You'd get a fingerprint. I'd see these 500 genes upregulated and these 300 genes downregulated, and you know what? This thing works just like trichloroethylene, so it's probably going to cause kidney trouble. So that was the general idea, and that pertained to a lot of different areas. The on-off patterns, and then there were a whole lot of pathway-level changes that were studied, identifying functional classes of compounds. So this one works like those, hence it's going to be neurotoxic, and it's going to do this, and it's going to do that. And a range of applications, not just in chemicals and chemical mixtures, but microbial area, triggers for tiered testing, and extrapolation across species. So it was a broad array of work that opened up. I'm going to show you where I think it's going to some degree and some of the things we did in our systems biology work and why we think this is one way to approach the problem. When you look at an individual is a system of systems. They're not just a person. Starting at the molecular level, working your way up through signal transduction pathways in the cells interacting with themselves to form organs, the organs interacting in the body to form systems, and the whole body itself functioning to keep you alive. That's an entire system of systems. And that's what the human body is. And when we measure things and look at things for human systems, we use a broad array of tools. It's not just genomics. There's a whole plethora of tools that we throw at this whole concept of trying to understand the toxicity of a compound. And so it's not just using molecular biology to move us forward. It's using all of this information, all of this technology to drive where we're going to go. Now, in looking at predicting human cancer risk using pathways and their canonical structures, which is something we were interested in even before Dan and his group wrote their nice little book, we'd been working on this issue. There are several ways you can do it. What we were interested really was trying to go from pathway-based analyses in the center down pathway D. We wanted to be able to use that to predict human carcinogenicity data or human toxicity data or human disease. And so my lab got to thinking about how we would go about doing this. And the first thing we asked ourselves, and most people have done the same thing, is we don't know how to prove we're right. Because, you know, most of the stuff that's been done out there in cancer and other toxic endpoints with chemicals is in laboratory animals. And did we really want to predict sick laboratory animals, or do we want to predict humans? So our first challenge to ourselves was, how do we do this with only human data? Can we actually produce something that's based only on human data that will predict human response? And we came up with one way to do it. So remember I told you about all those studies about metabolism genes and human disease and the gene-environment interaction stuff? Well, it turns out there's 22,000 papers in the literature that deal with human genetic polymorphisms and human disease, showing relationships between various genetic polymorphisms and various human diseases. And we thought, let's use that. If anything's causative in modifying pathways and causing disease, it's genes that you're born with that are slightly different than somebody else's gene that puts you at higher risk of getting a disease. I don't have to worry about a chemical causing it, maybe or maybe not. You had it since birth. It's been there the whole time. There's an association. Let's start with that. And there's a lot of data. So we took that, and then we said, what we can do is, given those gene-disease connections, we can take the genes and see if they form groups in the same pathways. And then what we can do is link the genes to the pathways, and by doing that, we have now linked the pathways to the genes. And we came up with a statistical tool for doing that, and it took into account the structure of the pathway, like a map, and that was great for us. We got a bunch of publications out of that. That was a lot of fun. So now we built that, and then we said, now how do we do the prediction? Well, here comes gene chips. I've got a gene chip. I apply a chemical to it in a human cell line. I see genes going up and down in that assay, and I can take those that are significantly changed. I can link them to pathways, and then, given the pathways that those genes are linked to, if there's a lot of the same pathways from those chemical gene interactions in human disease, then I'm going to link that chemical to the human disease. It's a very simple concept. And I've done it without using a single animal bioassay. So there is a genetic association database that NIEHS paid to have built. It's a really nice database. Not NIEHS. We paid part of it, but it was paid for by Aging Institute, NIH. And it's in Becker 2004 Nature Genetics. That was the last I saw of it. There's the 28,000 genetic polymorphism records. After we boiled through it and everything else, we ended up with about 8,900 unique associations between about 2,000 genes and 200 human diseases. There's a comparative toxicogenomics database, which has gone through the literature and collected everything they can on genomics associated with chemicals and pharmaceuticals and vitamins and dietary supplements and everything they could find. And there we had about 1,400, 1,500 chemicals in a variety of assays, some in animals, some in human cell lines, some in animal cell lines, all kinds of things. We took all of it, okay? Now we have everything we need, genomics data, genetic polymorphism data, human disease. We put it all together with our mathematical biomathematical modeling, and this is what we ended up with. This is an interactome. It's an interactome. I've only got 400 chemicals in here and 200 human diseases. But it shows you how closely they are linked to each other. And I'll walk you through it briefly. The circle in the upper right-hand corner, that green, those are neurologic diseases. So these are things like schizophrenia, people who attempt suicide, things like depression, chronic depression. They were all closely related to each other, so they show up in a cluster all by themselves. the little things that have names near them all over the place, those are the chemicals. And you can see that for the neurological diseases, there's almost no chemicals associated with them because we found nothing in this database that associated well with neurological diseases. If you go on the bottom left, you see all the purple diseases linked together. Those are metabolic and gastrointestinal diseases. And you can see there are chemicals interspersed in there, a few chemicals. There are about 30 or 40 chemicals in there. And that one in the paper we're looking at here, we actually took apart and went to each of those chemicals and see if there was historical literature that linked them to any of the metabolic diseases. And of course, there were. We were looking at things like PPAR alpha. We were looking at chemicals such as some of the dietary supplements, fish oils. All of these things are known to alter metabolism. Some of the neurological drugs that treat depression are known to cause obesity through modification of metabolic pathways. Those drugs didn't match up with neurologic. They matched up with metabolic. So we saw the types of connections that we wanted to see. The final thing I'll point out to you here that we found interesting in this picture was if you look at the cardiovascular diseases, which are the blue ones, they're all over the place. None of them seem to be associated with each other. They seem to be independent, different diseases, which is an interesting finding in and of itself as well. And that big blob in the middle, the yellow ones, that's cancer, which has got lots of chemicals associated with it. We didn't even attempt to go through that. Dan talks about toxicity pathways, or the NRC report talks about toxicity pathways. I argue there are no such things as toxicity pathways. There are pathways, metabolic, signal transduction pathways in the human body in virtually any mammalian and cellular system. They're there. What we're looking at is the perturbation of those pathways by chemicals that then, under chronic exposure, induce toxicity. They're not toxicity pathways. They're pathways that, when improperly motivated, induce toxicity. And through what we just did, I can tell you where the toxicity pathways are. Because I can do a map like this. The KEG pathways that we were using are all actually interconnected. You don't have independent pathways. The biochemistry of the cell is a completely linked chemical reactor. And so they're all linked, and this just shows the linkages between the various pathways that we were looking at. But here, the size of the pathway tells you how many diseases were linked to that pathway, the circle around that pathway. The color tells you how many chemicals were linked to that pathway. Big circles, dark color, seem to be the targets of multiple diseases and multiple chemicals. That may or may not be useful, but that clearly is a pathway you want to look at for toxicity. Small circles, very dark, that is a pathway that is specific to a given disease, but a lot of chemicals seem to be hitting it to get to that disease. So you can just, with a simple picture like this, begin to see where you think the critical toxicity pathways, as they describe them, might be. And these are some of them that we saw that were highly ranked. The next question, that just identifies toxicity. It doesn't tell you anything that you can use for risk assessment. So the next thing we did was go at two things in one shot. Species extrapolation using the same basic technology and dose response. Two critical factors involved in using this type of technology. This is from 20 animal bioassays done by the National Toxicology Program. We have the carcinogenicity data for that. Rusty Thomas over at, what's it called now? Hamner Institute. I still want to call it CIT. Had done some 90-day studies on the same chemicals for us. So we were looking at whether we could take a short exposure of 90 days in mice, do some genomics on them, and predict the 2-year chronic carcinogenicity study findings in one shot. That was our goal. And we went through the same basic concept of doing the genomics, linking the pathways, and then trying to see how the pathways linked up to find the chemicals, the carcinogenicity itself. This shows you how well we did. These are liver carcinogens here, which is what we were trying to predict, liver carcinogenicity. And then the ones that are in blue down through here, they don't cause liver cancer, but they caused other cancers in the body, not liver cancer. And the ones that were black are non-carcinogens. And we did okay. In terms of sensitivity, we did kind of okay. We got about 90% sensitivity and about 65% specificity. For a predicting model of this sort, that's not bad. Then we said, well, you know what? NTP has a whole bunch of the same things, same chemicals, same type of thing in rats, Fisher 344 rats. So let's go grab the 90-day studies from the NTP. Let's get them to do some genomics for us for five or six of these studies, and let's see if we can predict them with our mouse model. Because we've got the mouse model all set up. If we get the genomics in the rat, we can run it through the mouse model and see if we predict the mouse. That's important for us using this type of technology to maybe eventually predict a human. Well, that didn't work at all. As you can see here, and these are, let's skip this one for a minute. These are the chemicals we looked at. The red ones are carcinogens. The black ones are not. And you can see that we got one out of three carcinogens, and none of the rest were positive. It's positive here if you're above the red line. If the center is above the red line, that's what we're declaring positive. Then I thought, you know what? We have all this data that we did in the other paper on the linkage between pathways and human disease using human data. Let's see if the mouse genomics, I mean the rat, the mouse genomics model, if I take the genes that are associated with liver cancer in humans, those genetic polymorphisms, and run them through my mouse model, do I get prediction of liver cancer? And that's what this picture is, and yes, indeed, I actually get prediction of liver cancer in humans. So that sort of works. That's an interesting twist on this. Then I went and I said, oh, you know what, though? I wonder if it predicts all human diseases. You know, it might be that I got the right genes that take me into that pool of the pathway that is hit by every disease, and it's not going to be specific. So we went back and did them all. And you can see that we got liver cancer, colorectal cancer, and prostate cancer showing up with our mouse model for liver cancer. So that's an interesting twist. I still don't know exactly how to interpret it for the species extrapolation, but it's something interesting. Finally, looking at dose response, we did the same thing. Here, instead of having just one 90-day study, we had multiple doses of 90-day studies. We did the genomics in each one and tried to predict the bioassay result, and that's what you're looking at here, and that actually worked fairly well. These are all statistically significant positive predictions. So, what did we learn in our exercise? Pathways can help to distinguish mechanisms. We have no doubt about that, and we have no doubt that they give some information about disease risks. We need a new paradigm for evaluating those risks. This presents one potential paradigm. And we need to be focused on what human data can tell us. We don't have to just do this in a laboratory. There's lots of data out there on humans that can be put into play here, and I think that's an important finding from what we did. All of this is being oversold, in my opinion. I'm overselling it to you, and all of the other people doing it are overselling it. There are huge uncertainties associated with all of this that we have to, as a society, decide to accept or not accept. It took years for the society to accept the fact that if I see cancer in a rat or a mouse, I'm going to be worried about it. And that simple conceptual framework compared to these conceptual frameworks for managing risk. So I think there's a big societal legal issue here. Finally, the TOX21 screening program. I just want to point out one thing to Dan. That it started with the NTP Vision and Roadmap, not with the National Academy of Sciences report. And they were well underway to the Memorandum of Understanding with EPA and with the NIH long before that. But the point is that this is moving us in the direction of some of the things I've talked about. There's a lot of in vitro laboratory work being played out that's going to play into this type of analysis in the future. I would be remiss if I didn't point out who did all the work. This is my lab when I was at NIEHS and several of the groups we associated with, but these two guys, Julia Gokey and Ruben Thomas, were the brains behind it all. Julia had the idea, the dream of seeing this, and worked through all the databases. Ruben did all the math, worked out how you do this. And they, between the two of them, they were the only two who were able to actually see this succeed. And finally, with that, I'll thank you and answer any questions later. And Jesse comes back.